Iran reacts to the U.S. allegation that it plans to supply drones to Russia. It says its cooperation with Moscow in new technology fields predates the Ukraine war. Russia says it's destroyed anti-ship Harpoon missiles supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. in the Odessa region. And the United Nations facing criticism for dropping Israel from its list of shame of child killers again, and that despite the death of nearly 80 Palestinian kids. Welcome. Iran has reacted to a U.S. claim that it's planning to supply hundreds of drones to Russia. Foreign Ministry spokesman said there is no recent development in technological cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Nasser Kanani says Iran's cooperation with Russia in the field of some new technologies predates the war in Ukraine. He added that his country's stance on the war in Ukraine is quite clear and has been officially announced. The spokesman noted that Washington's claim comes as the U.S. and Europe have for years turned aggressive countries, including in the West Asia region, into a storehouse of their lethal weapons. On Monday, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan claimed that Tehran is preparing to send several hundred drones to Russia for use in Ukraine. The Russian president will travel to Tehran next week to attend a summit with his Iranian-Turkish counterparts over Syria. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has confirmed Vladimir Putin's scheduled visit on July the 19th. The trilateral summit among Putin, Reis, and Erdogan will be within the scope of the Astana peace process for Syria. This will be Putin's second foreign trip since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war on February 24th. Iran, Russia, and Turkey are set up the Astana peace process in January 2017, the capital Kazakhstan, Astana, that was renamed to Nur Sultan in 2019. The talks are aimed at putting an end to the Syrian conflict through the involvement of the Syrian government and the opposition. The 18th round of talks on Syria took place in Nur Sultan, in June. The UN Security Council has voted to extend humanitarian aid deliveries to northwestern Syria via Turkey, and that after a previous authorization expired on Sunday.
The result of the voting is as follows. 12 votes in favor, no votes against, 3 abstentions. The draft resolution has been adopted as Resolution 2642.
The 15-member UN body reached a deal on its third attempt. The U.S., the U.K., and France abstained from the vote after their proposal for a one-year extension was vetoed by Russia on Friday. Moscow also failed on its own push for 6 months' renewal with the argument that the Western draft resolution had ignored the sovereignty of Damascus. Now, with a new authorization, shipments containing food, medicine, and shelter will be sent to Syria's Idlib province until January 10th through a Turkish border crossing. Northwestern Syria is partially held by foreign-backed militant groups. Russia says any assistance to them would require the authorization of the Syrian government. The Russian Defense Ministry says it has destroyed anti-ship Harpoon missiles supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. in the Odessa region.
The Russian armed forces continue their special military operation in Ukraine. High-precision land-based Iskander missiles destroyed the launchers of U.S.-made Harpoon anti-ship missiles in the area of Berezan, Odessa region.
The ministry spokesman also said that Russian forces have detected potential foreign fighters in Ukraine. Konashenkov says that those mercenaries are intending to join the Ukrainian military. He urged them to leave the country, warning that they are not recognized by international law and would receive a lengthy jail term if caught. The spokesman said, however, that the number of foreign fighters has recently decreased to some 2,700. Kiev puts that number at 20,000. Meantime, Ukraine has launched a deadly attack on Russian-controlled Kherson to reclaim the region. According to pro-Russia authorities, attacks have killed 7 people. The Ukrainian military says at least 52 Russian forces have lost their lives. Kiev also says its forces have targeted artillery and armored vehicles as well as ammunition depot in the region. Earlier on Sunday, Ukraine urged Kherson's residents to evacuate urgently. The region fell to Russian forces in the early weeks of Russia's military operation, which is approaching its 5th month. The region that's located northwest of the Crimea Peninsula is strategic in the eastern Donbass region. Dozens of refugees live in appalling conditions on the streets of Belgium, but none of them are from Ukraine. Rights groups say that the EU's asylum policy is discriminatory. From Brussels, Jerome Hughes has a report.
It's 7 a.m. on Tuesday, the 12th of July, 2022, and these are the scenes outside Belgium's largest asylum application centre, located at Le Petit Château, close to Brussels city centre. Dozens try to sleep, while dozens more queue up as they wait for the centre to open.
I claimed asylum 1 year ago and I still have nowhere to sleep. You can see all the people on the streets. There's no place to eat or to have a shower.
Look at them, you can see the situation. This situation has been from a long time ago. When you claim asylum, so you shouldn't be in the street like this.
We escaped war in Afghanistan. We came here for help, but have to sleep on the streets and in the park. There is no help for us.
These homeless people are mainly from African countries and Afghanistan. None are from Ukraine.
On the face of it, this might look like a Belgian problem, but perhaps we should be pointing the finger at the EU. The 27-country bloc has bent over backwards to provide housing and education for Ukrainian refugees and deliver a whole host of other benefits. Of course, nobody could argue with that. But is this not discrimination?
That's a question we put to the European Commission.
Is there a two-tier unfair asylum system in the EU?
We work closely with the member states that they have under their competence, and with our support, they need to follow up and ensure contingency planning and adequate support for all those fleeing war and persecution so that there is no difference in their treatment.
Critics say Western nations tore countries in Africa and the Middle East apart and now turn their backs on displaced citizens. This as there is no end of money to support Ukrainians. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
When it comes to U.S. spending priorities, the numbers seem especially misguided in an era of tight budgets to come. Lawmakers have again opted to shower the Pentagon with cash rather than address the country's most pressing issues. Those issues, from poverty and hunger to health care, have left tens of millions of Americans in precarious conditions.
The devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout continue to take a toll on the world and provide ample reason to reconsider where taxpayers' money is being spent. Several countries have even come to the conclusion that their budget is better off being spent where it can potentially ameliorate the economic pressure on their citizens. In the U.S., however, while such reassessments are long overdue along with the trillions of dollars Congress and successive administrations have lavished on the Pentagon, lawmakers have decided to once again shower the Pentagon with cash, even more than what it asked for. Interestingly enough, this comes while the massive U.S. arsenal and fighting force deployed worldwide have proven to be powerless against grave, non-military threats to national security. Gas prices in the U.S. are at an all-time high. Rent prices have set records for the last 13 months straight. Inflation is increasing so sharply that even the cost of basic utilities has risen by nearly 30% in the last 12 months. There are growing fears that the economy is poised to fall into recession. And now, at a time when Americans are fighting to keep roofs over their heads and feed their families, Congress's plan is to authorize a record-setting $838.8 billion in spending to the Pentagon, nearly $40 billion more than what the military asked for.
American taxpayers should be angry. They are angry. Many are not only angry, they are incensed, and they are protesting. But unfortunately, too many elected representatives in this country aren't listening to their constituents. They're listening to the representatives and the lobbyists of the military-industrial complex, such as Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and General Electric. So when you have those companies and so many others that are pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into the political campaigns of members of Congress and members of the Senate and the president, when they are pouring millions of dollars into their political campaigns, when they spend just an inordinate amount of time on Capitol Hill lobbying for their interests, then you're going to wind up with policies and programs that are sending money to the Pentagon instead of sending money into states for schools and retirement programs and the other types of social welfare programs and that are needed in this country.
The United States has been fighting wars constantly since invading Afghanistan in 2001, and this nonstop warfare has come at the expense of American citizens and taxpayers. But the question is, why do the U.S. pursue war strategies like in Ukraine and many other parts of the world when its own citizens are suffering so immensely?
The U.S. Congress is on track to give the Pentagon $37 billion more than what the military asked for. And this comes while Congress could use this money to pay for a variety of things Americans desperately need right now, like school lunches, affordable housing, and utility assistance programs. Even just lowering taxes by that amount or giving this money directly to the American people could put more than $100 in the pocket of every single American at a time when they desperately need it. Not only would spending in such ways benefit the individuals and communities that receive them, it would also help revitalize the U.S. economy and make it more equitable to boot. As has been well documented, defense spending is one of the least economically productive ways the government can spend its money. Spending on education, healthcare, and lowering taxes, for example, have all been shown to create more and higher-paying jobs. So why is Congress poised to give government contractors the biggest taxpayer-funded payday they've ever received, despite the heavy economic implications that the move has on the country?
Well, the reason that the United States government is pursuing war strategies is because America is still an imperial hegemon. And so you have people like Tony Blinken and Avril Haines, Samantha Power, Jake Sullivan, Victoria Nuland that are influencing decision makers in policy to try to start fights with Russia, try to start conflicts with China, start to continue to try to start conflicts with Iran to justify this immense military spending.
Pentagon contractors invest heavily in efforts to get more taxpayer money. They've spread their influence and money around the lobbyists, PR firms, and think tanks to ensure that the money is funneled in their way. In short, this is the military-industrial complex, and it is working overtime to raise the Pentagon budget at taxpayers' expense. And while much of Washington is on the racket and will also profit from this wasteful government spending, it's Americans struggling to keep the lights on who will pay the price.
Okay, moving on, the United Nations has released its annual report on children in armed conflict. It has drawn criticism for omitting Israel from the list of shame, despite the killing of nearly 80 Palestinian children. The Palestinian deaths are among more than 2,500 child killings verified by the UN across the world last year. But Israel is not on a blacklist of child killers. UN Chief Antonio Guterres says that Israel will be added to the list for the 2022 report if it repeats its high numbers of violations. And that has drawn strong criticism from human rights bodies. They say that dropping Israel is another missed opportunity for accountability. The groups argue Israel, year after year, got away with committing serious crimes against children with virtual impunity. The UN has recently also faced criticism for omitting Saudi Arabia from its child killer list, despite kids being killed in Yemen. Political commentator Moti Abu Musaba believes that removing Israel from the UN list of child killers amounts to a crime.
Actually, excluding the Israeli occupation from such an investigation and lifting off the Israeli occupation from that list, I think, is a crime itself. Because anyone worldwide has the little bit of a humanity, understands and realizes clearly that the real position and the true position of the Israeli occupation should be at the top of that list. because Israel has a long history of targeting and killing the Palestinian people as a whole and the Palestinian children specifically. Since the beginning of 2022, more than 13 Palestinian children were killed. In 2021, in the May aggression, more than 67 Palestinian children were slaughtered and buried alive under the rubble of their residential houses after they were struck and bounded by the Israeli airstrikes in full view of the whole world. In the 2014 aggression, as Palestinians commemorate the eighth anniversary of that aggression, more than 550 Palestinian children were killed deliberately by the Israeli occupation.
British troops routinely took part in the killing of Afghan civilians during their stay in the war-ravaged country, and that according to a four-year investigation by national broadcaster BBC. The investigation says the British military reports suggest one Air Force unit alone might have killed at least 54 Afghans. It cited individuals who served with the Special Air Service as saying that they witnessed the killing of unarmed people during night raids. They saw the operatives dropping weapons at a scene to justify that those killed were terrorists. The findings also suggest that high-ranking officers, including Sir Mark Carleton Smith, former head of UK Special Forces, were aware of those killings. The BBC also found evidence suggesting Carleton Smith failed to pass on evidence to a murder inquiry. Britain was part of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 and withdrew its forces in 2014. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
In the summer of 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court decided District of Columbia versus Heller, in which the court held for the first time that the Second Amendment protected an individual right to gun ownership. We were law clerks to Justice Antonin Scalia, who wrote the majority opinion, and Justice John Paul Stevens, who wrote the lead dissent. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by Kate Shaw and John Bash. Kate Shaw is a professor of law at Cardozo Law School. John Bash is an attorney in private practice in Austin, Texas. The piece is titled, "We Clerked for Justices Scalia and Stevens. America is Getting Heller Wrong." Please stay with us for more. In the summer of 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court decided District of Columbia versus Heller, in which the court held for the first time that the Second Amendment protected an individual right to gun ownership. We were law clerks to Justice Antonin Scalia, who wrote the majority opinion in that case, and Justice John Paul Stevens, who wrote the lead dissent. Justices Scalia and Stevens clashed over the meaning of the Second Amendment. Justice Scalia's majority opinion held that the amendment protected an individual right to keep a usable handgun at home, which meant the District of Columbia law prohibited such possession was unconstitutional. Justice Stevens argued that those protections extended only to firearm ownership in conjunction with service in a well-regulated militia, in the words of the Second Amendment itself. We each assisted a boss we revered in drafting his opinion and were able to acknowledge that work without breaching any confidences. Justice Scalia had a practice of signing one opinion for a clerk each term, which permitted the clerk to disclose having worked on that case. And for John, that was Heller. Justice Stevens noted in his 2019 autobiography, The Making of a Justice, that Kate was the Heller clerk in his chambers. We continue to hold very different views about both gun regulation and how the Constitution should be interpreted. Kate believes in a robust set of gun safety measures to reduce the unconscionable number of shootings in this country. John is skeptical of laws that would make criminals out of millions of otherwise law-abiding citizens who believe that firearm ownership is essential to protecting their families. And he is not convinced that new measures, like bans on widely owned firearms, would stop people who are willing to commit murder from obtaining guns. Kate believes that Justice Stevens' dissent in Heller case provided a better account of both the text and history of the Second Amendment, and that in any event, the method of historical inquiry the majority prescribes should lead to the court upholding most gun safety measures, including the New York law pending before the Supreme Court. John believes that Heller correctly construed the original meaning of the Second Amendment and is one of the most important decisions in U.S. history. We disagree about whether Heller should be extended to protect citizens who wish to carry firearms outside of their home for self-defense, and if so, how states may regulate that activity. Issues that the Supreme Court is set to decide in the New York case in the next month or so. But despite our fundamental disagreements, we're both concerned that Heller has been misused in important policy debates about our nation's gun laws. In the 14 years since the Heller decision, Congress has not enacted significant new laws regulating firearms, despite progressives' call for such measures in the wake of mass shooting incidents. Many politicians cite Heller as the reason, but they are wrong. Heller does not totally disable government from passing laws that seek to prevent the kind of atrocities we saw in Uvalde, Texas. And we believe that politicians on both sides of the aisle have, intentionally or not, misconstrued Heller. Some progressives, for example, have blamed the Second Amendment, Heller, or the Supreme Court for mass shooting incidents. And some conservatives have justified contested policy positions merely by pointing to Heller, as if the opinion resolved the issues. Neither is fair. Rather, we think it's clear that every member of the court on which we clerked joined an opinion, either majority or dissent, that agreed that America's Constitution leaves elected officials an array of policy options when it comes to gun regulation. Justice Antonin Scalia, the foremost proponent of originalism, who throughout his tenure stressed the limited role of courts in difficult policy debates, could not have been clearer in the closing passage of Heller, that the problem of handgun violence in this country is serious, and that the Constitution leaves the government with a variety of tools of combating that problem, including some measures regulating handguns. Heller merely established the constitutional baseline that the government may not disarm citizens in their homes. The opinion expressly recognized presumptively lawful regulations, such as laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms, as well as bans on carrying weapons in sensitive places, like schools. And it noted, with approval, the historical tradition of prohibiting the carrying of dangerous and unusual weapons. Heller also recognized the immense public interest in prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill. Nothing in Heller casts doubt on the permissibility of background check laws or requires the so-called Charleston loophole, which allows individuals to purchase firearms even without completed background checks. Nor does Heller prohibit giving law enforcement officers more effective tools and greater resources to disarm people who have proved themselves to be violent or mentally ill, as long as due process is observed. Heller also gives the government at least some leeway to restrict the kinds of firearms that can be purchased. Few would claim a constitutional right to own a grenade launcher, for example, although where that line could be constitutionally drawn is a matter of disagreement, including between us. Indeed, former President Donald Trump banned bump stocks in the wake of the mass shooting incident in Las Vegas. Most of the obstacles to gun regulations are political and policy-based, not legal. It's laws that never get enacted, rather than ones that are struck down because of an unduly expansive reading of Heller. We're aware of no evidence that any perpetrator of a mass shooting incident was able to obtain a firearm because of a law struck down under Heller. But Heller looms over most debates about gun regulation, and it often serves as a useful foil for those who would like to deflect responsibility, either for their policy choice to oppose a particular gun regulation proposal, or for their failure to convince their fellow legislators and citizens that the proposal should be enacted. The closest we've come to major new federal gun regulation in recent years came in the post-Sandy Hook effort to create expanded background checks. The most common reason offered by opponents of that legislation, that it would violate the Second Amendment. But that's just not supported by the Supreme Court's interpretation of the amendment in Heller. If opponents of background checks for firearm sales believe that such requirements are unlikely to reduce violence while imposing unwarranted burdens on lawful gun owners, they should make that case openly, not rest on a mistaken view of Heller. Supreme Court justices don't control the way their writings are interpreted by later courts and other institutions. Certainly, law clerks don't. So we're not asserting that our views on Heller are in any way authoritative. But we know the opinions in the case inside and out. As the nation enters yet another agonizing conversation about gun regulation, in the wake of the Uvalde mass shooting tragedy, all sides should focus on the value, judgments, and empirical assumptions at the heart of the policy debate, and they should take moral ownership of their positions. The genius of our Constitution is that it leaves many of the hardest questions to the democratic process.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Keeping the occasion in mind, I would like to talk about the importance of imamate in the context of Ghadir. Whether this is essential part of the faith or not, or is it one of the furu'at? Does it come under usul-e-deen or under furu'd-deen? And just to, you know, keeping the time in mind, I would just like to concentrate on the event of Ghadir. Because the question comes up, you know, is really the event of Ghadir that important for us? Was it a divine appointment of the vicegerency of Amir al-Mu'mineen? Or was it just a wish of the Prophet out of his intense love for his cousin and his son-in-law? That's what we are told. That he was probably not making that as a legislation or a law. This was just his desire. If Muslims followed, that's good. If not, it's okay. And this is where we are to realize, you know, just to do this, we are not, I'm not even going to hadith or to history. Just look at ayat number 67 of Surah Maida, the fifth chapter of the Quran, which was revealed in connection to the event of Ghadir. I don't want to give you a long list of references, but I can assure you that in the research done by Allama Amini rahmatullah alayh, in his famous book Al-Ghadir, in the very first volume, he actually talks about the revelation of this ayat, Ya ayyuhar rasul, balligh ma unzila ilayka min rabbik. This ayat number 67 of Surah Maida, he gives 30 references from the Sunni scholars that this was revealed in Ghadir. Very quickly, just the names of some of the important figures here. You know, Tabari in his Kitab al-Vilaya, narrating from Zayd bin Arqam. Hafiz Razi, quoted by Suyuti, says that, you know, this is the narration which comes from Abu Sa'id al-Khudri. Al-Hafiz Mahamili in his Amali talks about this ayat being revealed in Ghadir. Hafiz Abu Bakr al-Shirazi says the same thing. Hafiz Ibn Mardaway also gives three narrations by three prominent Sahaba about this ayat coming in Ghadir. Then we have Tha'labi Nishapuri in his Tafsir, Al-Kashf al-Bayan, says the same thing. Hafiz Abu Nu'aym al-Isfahani. Then Wahidi al-Nishapuri in his book Asbab al-Nuzul, which talks about the occasions when the ayat were revealed, says the same thing from Abu Sa'id al-Khudri. Then you have Sajistani, and finally the last name I'll give here, just 10, first 10 out of the 30, is Hakim Haskani in Shawa'idh al-Tanzil, where he quotes Abdullah ibn Abbas and Jabir al-Ansari. And if you look at just these 10, you know, sources, the companions who connected this ayat to Ghadir are very prominent ones. Zayd bin Arqam is a very senior Sahabi. Abu Sa'id al-Khudri, about whom the Prophet said that the sky has not shadowed anyone more truthful, and the earth has not, you know, lifted anyone more truthful than Abu Sa'id al-Khudri. And this is where, you know, we talk about Abu Sa'id al-Khudri and many others, Abdullah ibn Abbas, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, then Jabir ibn Ansari. And these are the prominent Sahaba that we have. Now, going back to the ayat itself, and just look at the ayat, and that will show you the importance of the concept of wilayat and imamat in Islam. When you look at the ayat, look at the tone and the style used by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Again, ayat 67 from Surah Ma'idah. The very first thing, the way Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala addresses the Prophet, it is very formal, very official. No more Habib and Mahbub. You know that concept. You know, normally when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks to the Prophet more in an informal, kind of a personal way, he says Yasin, Taha, Muzammil, Mudassir, and things like that. No, here it's a very formal style. Ya ayyuhar Rasul, Muhammad, this is a very serious matter. It is between me, Rabbul Alameen, and you, my Rasul. You are the messenger here. He doesn't even use the words ayyuhan Nabi. He has used that 13 times in the Quran. But there is a difference. Nubuwwat basically talks about the relationship between the person and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that the Nabi is in communication with Allah. He gets the news from him. Whether it is wajib for him to convey to others, no. And Nabi is the source of guidance. People go and ask him and he will guide them. Whereas Rasul is somebody who is told that I'm giving you the information and the message, it is your duty to go out and convey that to the people. And so even the choice of words, Ya Ayyuhar Rasul, is very important here. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, this is not just a, you know, I'm giving you some information about Ali or his wilayat and imamat. No, you are being designated here as a Rasul, the messenger. And it is your duty to deliver this message about the wilayat of Ali. Salawat Qurani Akbar. Ya Ayyuhar Rasul, Balligh. Balligh is a command form of the word, from tabligh, to deliver something, to convey something. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is giving a command here. It's not a matter of choice for Rasulullah. This is the command from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, balligh, convey. And that is the meaning of tabligh. And this word itself, this one single word, balligh, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is commanding Rasulullah to convey the message, to deliver the message that I have sent to you, this rejects this speculation that we see among some these days, that all wilayat and imamat of Ali was only Rasulullah's wish and preference, not a formal instruction given to him by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. No, here Allah is saying, Ya ayyuhar Rasul, you are my messenger. Deliver this message. And it's not that the Sahaba those days in that audience understood that, well, this is his wish. We'll see whether we want to follow it or not. Among the Sahaba, one is Abdullah ibn Abbas. I mentioned his name earlier about his narration from many sources that he's saying this ayat was revealed in Ghadir. And he's not only a Sahabi, he's known to be very learned even among Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. He's known as Hibrul Ummah, ink of the Ummah. And so the Hibrul Ummah, the way he understood, according to Ibn Mardaway, he says, فَوَجَبَتْ بِاللَّهِ فِي رِقَابِ الْقَوْمِ. This message that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is asking the Prophet to deliver to the people, فَوَجَبَتْ, it is an obligation, وَاللَّهِ, by Allah, on the people. Salawat wa akbar. And what was the message? We still haven't finished the ayat. Ya ayyuhar rasul balligh. Or the messenger, convey the message, deliver the message which has been given to you. What was the message? Well, he gathered them in Ghadir. Those who had gone ahead, they were told to come back. Those who were lagging back, they were, you know, told to move far forward. We do not exaggerate, nor we do go back. We are right in the middle there. If you go ahead, you will become ghali. If you stay back, you will become muqassir. So Rasulullah says, those who are gone there, come back. Those who are far, move forward, come to me. And then that's where he gives the khutbah, where he says that my life is coming to the end. And when a person is coming to the end of his life, what does he do? He says, I want to make sure that the process of succession is understood clearly. That was the message. Ya ayyuhar rasul, balligh ma unzila ilayka min rabbik. Abdullah bin Mas'ud, a very prominent Sahabi of Rasulullah. He is one of those considered to be the one who compiled the ayat of Quran in the formal way they talk about it. And Abdullah bin Mas'ud actually is the one who says, he explains this ayat. What was the message? He says the ayat is saying, Ya ayyuhar rasul, balligh ma unzila ilayka min rabbik, inna aliyan waliyul mu'mineen. We are not saying that, you know, these words were removed from the ayat of Quran. Abdullah bin Mas'ud is explaining. This is an explanatory, you know, tafsir of the Quran.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Ali Hali حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمني صل عليه.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
In Britain, a National Union of Students survey has found a third of all university students are left with £50 a month to live on after paying for rent and bills. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Sophie Zeldin O'Neill. The piece is titled One in Ten Students Turn to Food Banks in Cost of Learning Crisis. In Britain, more than one in ten students are using food banks because they cannot make ends meet during the cost of living crisis, according to a new survey by the National Union of Students, the NUS. The poll of more than 3,500 university students found that 11% of students are using food banks, up from 5% in January, while 96% are cutting back as a result of soaring prices and bills. One in five say they are unable to buy toiletries, and one in ten cannot purchase sanitary products when required. It was reported last month that there has been a 3,000% increase in the number of graduates who owe more than £100,000 in student loan debts. In 2016, the Sutton Trust charity found that British university graduates have the highest debt in the English-speaking world, and the average loan balance has risen since then. The National Union of Students survey found that a third of all university students are living on less than £50 a month after paying their rent and bills, with many reporting that their maintenance funds are not enough to pay for a weekly shop, allow them to travel to university, or cover their energy bills. The poll also revealed a cost of learning crisis, as three-quarters of university students said they would be unable to pay for course materials without more support. Four in ten, or 42%, say they're unable to make it on the university campus or are being forced to travel less, and 41% are neglecting their health so they can save money by missing out on extras such as dental appointments. 9 in 10, or 92%, say the crisis is affecting their mental health, with 31% of university students saying rising costs are having a major impact. Only a fifth of university students say they have received any government support, and only 8% said they felt ministers are doing enough to support them. More than 8 in 10, or 83%, have sought financial support through other means, such as using credit cards, buy now and pay later credit schemes, such as Klarna, or taking out bank loans. More than half, or 53%, of university students say they have turned to family and friends for support, while 40% have reached out to them for loans. According to the new National Union of Students survey, a third of students say the rising cost of living has also had an impact on their families. Students with caring responsibilities and disabilities, those who are estranged from their families, and people from poorer backgrounds have all been affected more by the cost of living crisis. A National Union of Students spokesperson said, "Huge increases in the price of bills, price of food and living costs, coupled with soaring rent, has students on the brink. We're seeing stress and anxiety piling on them from bouncing debt between different cards to stay afloat." Despite all of this, students are being completely ignored by the government. These findings are bleak. We're knee-deep in a cost-of-learning crisis that would affect the poorest students the hardest. The National Union of Students has called on the government to put in place a tailored cost of living support package for university students, as well as requesting that student maintenance provisions and the apprentice minimum wage be brought into line with the living wage. Meanwhile, union leaders have warned newly appointed cabinet ministers that many teachers and nurses will quit their professions in the coming weeks if public sector pay deals are further delayed by chaos at the top of the government. The decision last Thursday by Prime Minister Boris Johnson to step down as Prime Minister and a series of changes to his cabinet have left public sector workers increasingly fearful that long overdue pay rises will be pushed back to the autumn.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. One of the greatest advantages of Imam was that he familiarized the nation with the concept of resistance. It occurs many times that nations are after something but do not have the power to resist. When there is a pressure, they retreat. Imam built a nation like this. He injected resistance and steadfastness in them. That is why today the Iranian nation is a completely resistant and solid nation. Thank God, this is another blessing of our magnanimous Imam, and the term resistance, he entered into the political discourse of the world. The resistance taught to the Iranian nation and all of us by Imam has turned into an outstanding term in the political discourse of the world. I would like to raise an important point about the enemy's greed, plans, plots, and foolish schemes against the Iranian nation. This point is made of two parts. One is that today, the most important means of the enemies to inflict harm on the country is to pin their hopes on popular protest. They hope that with psychological work, internet and cyberspace activities, with the various forms, money and employment of mercenaries, they will be able to pit the people against the Islamic government and the Islamic Republic. This is the first part of the matter.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The second part of the matter is that this calculation of the enemy is wrong, just like many other calculations made by him. In the beginning of the revolution, they promised that the Islamic Republic would not live more than 6 months and that it would fall. When those 6 months passed, they renewed it, saying that it would happen 6 months later. More than 80 of these 6 months periods have passed now. On that day, the Islamic Republic used to be a thin sapling, but it has become a sturdy and deep-rooted tree, and it has become stronger on a daily basis. Their calculations were wrong back then, and they are wrong now too. This calculation is just like the previous ones. An example is their calculation during the Sacred Defense era. They helped Saddam thinking that he would destroy the Islamic Republic in the course of a few days. They helped the plotters of coups, hoping that they would do something. All these were calculations made by the Americans and Westerners, and all were wrong.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.